Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Sitting across from me now is a man with the unusual title of Director of Authorised Intervention at TUAM. Daniel McSweeney was appointed to the role by the Minister for Children in May and will oversee the excavation and recovery of children's remains at the former mother and baby home in the Galway town. It's now almost a decade since research by local historian Catherine Corliss brought world attention to the possibility that hundreds of babies and children were informally buried at the site adjacent to a home run by the Bon Secours religious order. Daniel McSweeney, thank you very much for joining me in studio this morning. Can we talk about you before we talk about your job, your new job? You're a solicitor. You haven't spent too much time in court or solicitor's office, though. Your career is taking you to some pretty interesting places.
Yeah, good morning, everybody. Yeah, so my name is Dan McSweeney from Cork. I went to college in Galway and then became a solicitor and worked as a solicitor for a number of years. And then in 2007, I decided to join the International Committee of the Red Cross, and initially thinking I'll do it for a year or two, and then I ended up doing it for 15, 16 years, and worked in Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Tunisia, Libya, back to Afghanistan, Lebanon. Then I was in Geneva in the headquarters for 4 years, and then most recently I was working in the Caucasus. So in all these kind of conflict and post-conflict
doing
zones.
What?
Doing protection work, what's called a protection work, which in my case really meant initially a lot of visiting of detainees, prisoners of war, people connected or detained in connection with conflict, and really with reference to the Geneva Conventions, looking at conditions of detention, treatment of detainees, contact with families. And the contact with families thing then becomes a question of separated families, putting them back together. You can see this a lot with what's happening in Ukraine. And then it becomes a focus on missing persons. And then the Red Cross, the ICRC, International Committee of the Red Cross, is one of the really preeminent organisations that looks at issues of separated persons and missing persons during and after a conflict.
And what in your career has given you the experience now to take on this job?
Yeah, I think, when I first became aware of the TUAM tragedy, I was working in Lebanon. So there I was leading work on the missing, clarifying the fate of the missing from the Lebanese Civil War. So there's more than 3,000 people missing after the Lebanese Civil War of 75 to 95. And we as Red Cross, or as the ICRC, were collecting information from families and from former combatants and others about how the war happened and where there might be graves. We were also collecting DNA from families and information that would allow remains, if and when they were found, to be identified. And we were working with the Lebanese authorities on how to actually set up an office, a bit like the office that I'm now setting up here. So I think that was a very good grounding in the issues that I'm dealing with now. When I was in Geneva for 4 years, my title was head of protection operations. So I was actually overseeing this type of work around the world. And I could see how the ICRC dealt with missing work in the Caucasus, in the Balkans, in Latin America. And then my last job was actually in the Caucasus, where I was essentially changing and reforming and rethinking how this work, missing work, was done on a variety of conflicts in the Caucasus that either were after the fall of the Soviet Union or in 2008.
So you were in Lebanon doing something not entirely dissimilar when Alison O'Reilly's story in the Mail on Sunday broke Catherine Corliss's bombshell to the world. Excuse me, I was in Catherine Corliss's kitchen like a couple of days later, struggling to get my head around the enormity of what it was that she had found and suspected had happened. And I asked her something which was even harder to compute at that time. I said, what do you think should happen to the 796 bodies? And she said with absolute clarity at that point 9 years ago, well, they have to be exhumed, they have to be returned to their relatives, their living relatives, and they have to be given a proper burial. And that struck me at the time as just being an enormous undertaking. Sitting in Lebanon, where you were as you heard this news, did you have any kind of inkling that that would be where we would end up?
I think once you think about exhumation, and I think that because of where these children are buried, that I think that's an imperative. And once you think about international forensic standards and best practice, this is where it leads. It leads to, and this then I think links to what my role is. You know, it's excavation, and then my role is excavation, examination of remains. It then, insofar as possible, identification, individualization, so bringing together each individual. It's looking at causes and circumstances of death, and then it is returning the remains that are identified to the families, and then unidentified remains are memorialized in a way that's selected and chosen by the families.
So that was, in your mind, the only appropriate thing that could be done once we had made a discovery of this enormity?
I think if you go to the 2017 expert technical group, they laid out five different options, and sort of the least option was you just have a memorial, and then the sort of greatest option was what we were doing here. But I think once you apply international standards, this is where you have to go.
Okay. Yeah. Now, all of that said, this is not going to be an easy task that you have ahead of you. I mean, let's talk about all the various people involved. Yeah. First off, anybody who knows anything about the site knows that it is not just adjacent to, but cheek by jowl with houses that are people's homes.
Yeah.
They're going to have to be given a fairly prominent voice in what it is that happens here and how it's conducted.
Yeah, I think there's, at this stage, which is the very start, there's two key constituencies. One is the families themselves. And I mean, I was appointed at the end of May, and I've really spent my time in the first few weeks meeting families, survivors, people who were in the mother and baby's home, and advocates, and going to them before I ever went to the media and explaining to them what I want to do and listening to their concerns. So that's the first part. The second part then is, as you say, the residents of Tuam. I need to have a relationship of dialogue, of exchange with the families and with the residents of Tuam. And that process begins next week, when I will meet with the county councillors from Tuam and the TDs from Galway East. It also began, I think, this week, because my first radio interviews were with Galway Bay FM and Midwest Radio. I spoke to the Tuam Herald and the Connacht Tribune. So there's really a concerted effort on my part, and will be on my staff's part, to have this relationship, exchange, consultation with families first, really all the way through the process, and those people in Tuam who are affected. So there will be opportunities for people in Tuam to really interact with us directly once we've kind of set things up a little bit.
How have your interactions with the families been? What sense have you got from them of your appointment? Are they relieved? Are they saying, at last? What?
Yeah, I think there's a sense of relief. There is, exactly, at last. The fact that I can come to them with not a plan yet, but at least a process. This is what the process looks like. This is what the office that I need to build looks like. These are the steps that I'm taking. So I think my impression is they're pleased that there's somebody there. Of course, they want the work to start, but they want the work to be done well. I think they're also happy that the office is independent. So I'm independent of the government. I've been appointed by the government, but I think I work, first of all, for the families, but I also work for all of us, because I think I'm trying to bring a degree of resolution for the families, for the residents, but for Irish people to this whole issue.
Along the way, there's another consideration that emerges here, though, and that is the level of forensic analysis that's going to be done. And are you going to establish, or try to establish where you can, cause of death?
I think when we look at the whole forensic aspect, there's what's possible in theory and there's what's possible in practice. And in theory, we can identify, you know, everybody that we find. Now, in reality, we don't know how many close relatives will come forward and give DNA, and that's one question. The second question is, we don't know what we'll find until we actually open up the gravesites. How many sets of remains will we actually find? What state are they in? Is it possible to recover DNA from the remains? And what state are they in terms of what they can tell us about causes and consequences of death? So there are three pots of information, or three pots of data. There's what we find in the site when we recover the remains. And I'm conscious that I'm talking about, you know, loved ones of families here. So it is very, very sensitive. It's what we recover from the site. It's what we get from the close relatives in terms of DNA. And then it's the research that we will do on the archives and data that is out there. Because while the Mother and Baby's Home Commission of Inquiry did a lot of work, and there were different perspectives on that. They looked at those archives with these very broad questions in mind of what happened. My questions are very narrow. It's identification, individualization, causes and circumstances of death.
There is understandably a lot of public interest in the matter, the manner in which the bodies were buried, and a lot of contradictory evidence from people who have seen or say that they have seen inside the grave when it was still in use. Some say that bodies were laid out in an orderly fashion on shelves. Others say that there was a jumble of mixed up remains in a large pit. Is that something that you're going to provide information on? Is it something that we need to know, or do we preserve the dignity of the deceased by saying, no, this is a part of this that we're going to draw a veil across?
Well, I think when I say that this work needs to be done with the families at the centre, it's what that means is that questions like that are discussed with the families right the way through. What do they want? Because it's ultimately their loved ones that are involved, and there is a balancing of the sensitivity of the families with the public interest in this whole issue. And I think that's something that we will have to gauge as we go through the whole process. I mean, I want to be transparent in how I'm working. I want to be very predictable in how I'm going through this, so everybody knows what's going on, while balancing this with the sensitivities and having really the families at the centre and having these discussions with them.
Which is presumably another question that you ask then of one of the more upsetting aspects of this, that the site was on top of or inside what had become, one assumes, a disused septic tank. Are you going to, do you see yourself establishing, was there any remediation work done on this septic tank before it became a burial site, or was it actually still a septic tank? Is that a question that you see yourself addressing?
Not necessarily. I mean, the focus is, as I said, these questions. I mean, my role is not to rewrite the Commission of Inquiry's report. So my focus is on these key questions, as I said, you know, identification, individualization, causes and circumstances of death.
But your excavation work is going to be considerably more extensive than that was.
Yeah, and I think there it's something that we will discuss with families and look at, but it's not my role, it's not my mandate, I mean, it's really about my mandate to look beyond those questions. So I think there it's in discussion with families that will decide on the way forward, but I need to remain within the mandates that's been given me and not go outside that.
Is there a written report at the end of your work?
Very much so, yeah. And
so it's not just a process of reunification and individual burial?
No. So the end point of this is identified remains with families, unidentified remains at a memorial that has been designed by families in a place to be decided by them, in a form decided by them, and then a report which will then focus on these questions. And I think the reality is that it's unlikely that all of the remains will be identified. Now, it's not a sort of black and white situation. You can also, we will probably have to do things like partial identification, which means that, okay, we could identify, you know, female of 8 months, male of 1 year, 2 months, other information that we can actually gather to try and at least give some identity, some dignity back to these poor children who...
Okay, who suspected that they were a relative came forward and offered a DNA sample, will you be able to match that?
Absolutely. Well, okay, that's one of the points I wanted to make. So if you are a family member out there who believes that a relative is buried in Tuam, there will be an opportunity in the coming months to come forward and provide DNA. And we will then use that DNA to try and make a match. Now, a match is not guaranteed, because the question then is, do we actually recover the remains of the relative? And then is DNA recoverable from those remains? Because that's always a question. But I think...
Because you have bones does not necessarily mean you can get a workable DNA sample.
Exactly. Particularly when these bones have been in the ground for 80, 90 years and possibly in a very wet environment. Because if an environment is wet, that can, you know, reduce the recoverable DNA from the remains. But for sure, we want family members to come forward if they want to. Equally, there are family members that won't want to come forward, and we respect that, and I think that's very, very important. There's also just scientific limits to this. You know, there are close relatives, it's easier to have a DNA match. More distant relatives, it's more difficult to have a DNA match. And of course, none of these dead children have children, of course.
a small question, but yeah, it might be of concern to some people if they were thinking about coming forward, is, do you know, is the state going to offer any financial assistance for the burial of remains, or is that a cost that would have to be borne by the families themselves?
I actually don't know that question, the answer to that question, but I'd certainly take note that it's something that we should look at.
Okay. Yeah. And what's the timeline on all of this now?
That's the big question. My appointment is for 2.5 years, and I think at the moment it is just me, and I'm building this office, hiring people, forensic staff, a lot of administrative staff, someone to deal with families, media, all of this. So we're really building this. We need to have a lab, which we haven't got yet. We need to have a big IT system because this is incredibly complicated. We need to write standard operating mm-hmm. procedures. So there's lots of preparation. I hope in 6 months to at least have an idea of when. I think I need a 6 month period as okay. a startup.
However yeah. long, do you have a sense that at the end of this process, we mm-hmm. are all collectively going to be able to draw a line under this episode?
I hope so. I hope so. I mean, the unknowns are how many family members will come forward and how many remains will be found and in what state. And I think those two things will dictate the number of identifications that we will have. And it may be a small number, it may be a large number. But I think the fact that we take these remains out of this place where they are, which is very inappropriate, and rebury them in a more appropriate place with the participation of all of these concerned stakeholders goes some way to bringing resolution. But there's no complete resolution to this because of the nature of what happened.
Mm. And indeed, all of the other mother and baby homes where the same questions arise now. But for your work and the job of work ahead of you, Daniel McSweeney, Director of Authorised Intervention at TUAM, good luck.
Thank you, Philip.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.